that want an affiliation with others that have had the experience that we're perhaps having at the time. And certainly this playback theater event is a perfect example of
wonderful form
for realizing that I'm not the only one that have had those feelings or that have been wrestling with those issues, and I need not do it in silence and alone.
This is Michelle Schroeder Fletcher from KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I've been speaking with Patty Lyons, Associate Director of NAMI Multnomah, which is the National Alliance of Mental Illness, Darrell Walker, CEO of Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare Incorporated, and our actor friend and wonderful performer, Ryan Bowen, who will be performing at Break the Silence, Break the Stigma, a wonderful one-time event and theater collaboration, Tuesday, September 15th, 7:30 at Artist Repertory Theater. Tickets available at breakthesilence.brownpapertickets.com. I can't thank you enough for all your work, your effort, your energy, your support in the community. It's made Portland better. We're all better for the experience. Thank you so much for joining us. We
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Other September 11th, film screening and discussion about the lasting impacts of the U.S.-funded military coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. The event will take place on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. This film screening will include two 30-minute documentaries that focus on Mapuche land reclamation and language revitalization, as well as a discussion with the filmmaker about the specific laws that have been used to target the indigenous Mapuche people since the dictatorship began in 1973. Again, that's the Other September 11th on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Joanna Moncrief. She is a senior lecturer at the University of College London. She's a practicing psychiatrist with the National Health Service and the co-chair of the Critical Psychiatry Network. Joanna is the author of the new book out in paperback, The Myth of the Chemical Cure, A Critique of Psychiatric Drug Treatment. She's widely published in medical journals in the UK and Europe, and she is also one of the editorial advisors of the publication by the Icarus Project and the Freedom Center that I authored, The Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs. So thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio, Joanna Moncrief.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, your book, The Myth of the Chemical Cure, A Critique of Psychiatric Drug Treatment, is really excellent detailed a look from a medical perspective on how drugs work and the myths and misunderstandings about what psychiatric drugs are all about. And we're going to be getting into that, and especially focusing on bipolar medications and bipolar disorder, especially lithium. Tell us about how you got interested in having a critical perspective on drugs and psychiatric treatments.
Well, when I started working in psychiatric hospitals as a junior doctor, what struck me immediately is how drugs were absolutely central to the process of treatment. Almost everyone who came in as an inpatient, and most people who were seen as outpatients, were on at least one sort of medication, and most people were on numerous different sorts of medication. And from my perspective, an awful lot of it didn't seem to be making that much difference. It seemed to cause a lot of secondary problems. And yet other doctors had a completely different perspective and seemed to think it was wonderful and people were getting better and because of the drugs. So I was aware that there were very different points of view about drug treatment early on, and that made me want to go and find out more about it.
And so what were some of the things that you've discovered and write about in your book?
Well, one of the things that interested me was the was the history of drug treatment. And when I looked back to the beginning part and the middle part of the 20th century, it was obvious that drug treatment, although it was used, didn't excite as much attention and interest as it does nowadays. And people didn't really think that drugs were curing people. They didn't think that drugs were altering the fundamental underlying problem. And then from the 1950s, that started to change. And psychiatrists started to believe that the drugs they had really were affecting the underlying disorder and helping to reverse it and to bring people back to normal. And yet, there wasn't really any evidence for that change in point of view. So that's what I've been looking at in my book and in other papers. I've been looking at the evidence base for how we view psychiatric drug treatments today and what it is, trying to understand what it is that they actually do to people.
Now, I guess the first drugs that were introduced sort of most famously was Thorazine, and that was, it's an antipsychotic, a neuroleptic antipsychotic, and the real innovation with Thorazine was that essentially it's a tranquilizer that doesn't put people to sleep. That's essentially why it's so useful in psychiatry, is that right?
That's right, and what's interesting is that the first people who used chlorpromazine in psychiatry recognized this and wrote about this very clearly. They wrote about how chlorpromazine creates this neurological syndrome, some of them called it. You know, they're almost talking about how chlorpromazine creates a neurological disease.
That's the medical term for...
Chlorpromazine is the generic name for Thorazine. It was marketed as Thorazine in the United States and Largactil in the UK.
Ah, okay.
So when chlorpromazine first came into use, the psychiatrists who were using it were very clear about what it was doing, and they described how it was producing this abnormal neurological syndrome that slowed people down and created this state of psychic indifference without just sedating people and sending people to sleep like the old sedatives had done. The barbiturates, which were used prior to Thorazine, had just made people very sleepy. So people thought it was a great breakthrough, but recognized that what it was doing was creating an abnormal neurological state. It wasn't just reversing an underlying disease. But then gradually that idea changed and people started to believe instead that it was an antipsychotic and that it was somehow reversing the processes that were leading to the psychotic symptoms.
They're basically still this tranquilizer, but it works more on the higher functions of the brain. And so people lose motivation. They become indifferent to what they're experiencing. I mean, I've been on antipsychotics. I was on Trilofan and Melaril, which are some of the older drugs. And they were very much, I mean, I remember blacking out from when I was on Melaril, just not having any consciousness at all. And then I remember just being very much like it was kind of like some kind of a vice or some kind of like a cotton or wool was on my mind, just totally sluggish and just was groggy and could not. But, you know, I was wandering around and sitting and watching television and sort of being there in the hospital.
Yes, that's a really good description. And they also seem to slow people down physically and cause physical restriction. They slow down movement. I mean, essentially, the older antipsychotic drugs cause a mild state of Parkinson's disease. We know that if you give high enough doses, they cause obvious Parkinson's disease-like symptoms. You know, people get very stiff. And what I think is happening at lower doses is that they're causing milder symptoms of Parkinson's disease, which is a slowing up of movement, a feeling of restriction, both physical and mental.
Very much like a tightening or a gripping of the body, a real, and you see people who are on high doses, they look, and that's, I think, where the term the Thorazine shuffle comes in, because you have this kind of like very stiff walk.
Yeah.
Because you're no longer free. Your muscles have been tightened up.
The antipsychotics block dopamine production, and therefore they're inducing an artificial Parkinson's type state.
And then when they became more widely used, that's when the idea of the dopamine hypothesis as causal for schizophrenia came in.
Yes. Now, that hypothesis followed from some experiments on haloperidol, and haloperidol is a very strong dopamine blocker. And when it was identified that haloperidol was working by blocking dopamine receptors, then people leapt to the conclusion that the underlying cause of schizophrenia must be overactivity of these dopamine receptors or the dopamine system.
And it sounds like previously to the introduction of the psychiatric drugs, there were much more psychological understandings of what schizophrenia is all about.
Yes, I think prior to the 1950s, there was a social psychiatry movement. Psychoanalysis was very influential in the United States. But there's always been a tendency within psychiatry to want to find biological causes and biological explanations for mental disorders. So that's always been there, but it was given a really great boost by the introduction of these drugs, because psychiatry could then present itself as having medical treatments the same as the rest of medicine. It could present itself as doing the same sort of thing, giving people drug treatments to treat specific conditions, supposedly. People in the psychiatric community, psychiatrists and researchers, again seem quite convinced that there is a dopamine abnormality underlying the symptoms of psychosis. Even though, as you say, there's an awful lot of negative evidence, the positive evidence is completely inconsistent.
So essentially the idea that there's a biochemical imbalance behind schizophrenia really came looking backwards on saying, well, these drugs seem to be working, so therefore it must be the drug action dealing with the underlying disease. But in fact, that's not what's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So the theory is already based on an assumption that if the drugs do something, they must be curing a disease. They must be working on the cause of the disease, the cause of the symptoms. And I often give, when I talk about different ways of understanding what psychiatric drugs do, I often give the example of alcohol and social anxiety. That we know that alcohol can be helpful for people with social anxiety, but that's not because they have an alcohol deficiency. That's because the state of intoxication that alcohol produces is characterized by a bit of social disinhibition, which can be useful if people are very socially anxious. But it doesn't say anything about the cause of the anxiety, the original cause of the anxiety.
Actually, this idea that there are recreational drugs on one hand, and then they're way different, there are pharmaceutical psychiatric drugs on the other, and we actually don't even like to call those drugs, we call them medications, that the action is completely different. But what you're suggesting is that just like alcohol has a toxic effect, and so it causes chemical changes in your brain, gives you an intoxicated experience that for some people might be useful for them in, say, a social anxiety situation at a party or dealing with crowds or meeting people. The same kind of dynamic takes place with psychiatric drugs, that they change consciousness, they intoxicate you, they work in similar kinds of mechanisms of disrupting brain chemistry, and then the effects may or may not be useful based on the intoxication. Is that a fair way of kind of assessing this?
Absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it. I think that we should think of psychoactive drugs as including all the drugs we use in psychiatry and recreational drugs, and there's no fundamental distinction between them. What I often say, there's no fundamental distinction between the drugs we use in psychiatry, like antipsychotics and antidepressants, and the drugs that people take for recreational purposes, like alcohol, cannabis, stimulants, etc.
Yeah, and we also know that with the recreational drugs, a lot of times people are taking them for emotional, psychological, social coping. So they're kind of like they're medicating themselves or
Absolutely.
Allowing themselves to be productive or effective. But the difference, of course, is that in psychiatry, you have this huge institutional authority machinery that's saying, wait a second here, there's this underlying disease and disorder, and the medications are treating it or dealing with it.
As you're saying, the thing that I think we're doing wrong at the moment is we're not understanding psychiatric drugs as drugs. We've got to understand them as drugs, as chemical substances that are alien to the body, that create an artificial state. It might be useful to take them, but whenever you take a drug of any sort, there are all sorts of dangers and hazards, and we need to treat them with that sort of, with respect. We need to understand them, understand what sort of effects they have, in order to be able to use them wisely.
And you described this perspective as the drug-centered approach. And what psychiatry has historically been doing is a disease-centered approach. And so actually there isn't a lot of education or research on how the drugs affect you in general. It's more focused on, well, how does it affect so-called schizophrenia as a disorder or a disease, or so-called bipolar disorder?
That's right, absolutely, yes. So we haven't understood these drugs properly. There are lots of things that these drugs are doing that we don't know very much about because we haven't looked at them as drugs, because we've just been obsessed with, do they alter the dopamine receptors, or do they, you know, do antidepressants raise your serotonin levels, instead of looking at all the other things they're doing and what consequences all those effects have.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why the negative effects of these drugs is so underplayed and overlooked in psychiatry, and it's considered just a part of the cost of treating a disorder or treating a disease?
Yes, absolutely. So what's happened is that instead of seeing psychiatric drugs as drugs, they've become treatments. And by becoming treatments, psychiatrists are then able to focus on the supposed disease and the benefits of the treatment, and all the negative aspects of using a drug get put into the small print, get shoved aside and obscured.
If you are just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We are speaking with Joanna Moncrief. She is a senior lecturer at the University of College London, a practicing psychiatrist, and the author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure, a critique of psychiatric drug treatment. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Let's talk about bipolar disorder specifically, and some of the research and insights that you have into these treatments that are given, and very much the message that I've talked to so many different people in my work with the Freedom Center and the Psychiatric Survivor Movement, and now as a counselor, and they are just getting a message: you have bipolar disorder, that your mood swings are part of an underlying problem in your brain. You were born with it. It's who you are. And therefore, you need the treatment. And what I'm seeing a lot is that people are really terrified. And one of the big messages is you need these medications, because if you don't take them, not only will you have another episode, but you could end up dying from suicide.
There's some really frightening stuff out there. And I was looking at a leaflet on this yesterday from the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which was suggesting that if you don't take treatment, you're going to have more frequent episodes. Now, I'm not convinced that that's been soundly shown. There aren't that many studies, long-term studies, of how many episodes people have. And the pattern of episodes seems to be very, very variable, actually. And the other thing that's happening with bipolar disorder at the moment is it's changed over the last 10 years. When I first went into psychiatry in the early 90s, there was a thing called manic depression. And this was a very rare condition in which people had severe episodes of mania or depression that lasted for several months at a time, and the rest of the time they'd be fairly normal. And now the idea has come about that actually there's many more people who have sort of milder versions of this, and that you can have bipolar nowadays if you have mood swings, you know, if your mood changes from day to day or from hour to hour. And so what it seems to me that's happened is that many more people who have ordinary emotional fluctuations are being diagnosed as having bipolar disorder and being put on potentially very toxic drug treatments for it. And one of the problems with this is that the research into the effects of drug treatment has only been done with this small group of people who have this much more severe and obvious disorder. And we don't know whether any of that research translates to the wider group of people who have some emotional fluctuations.
Now, historically, the treatment for bipolar disorder, and this is still true today, is lithium. Can you tell us about that? Because lithium has a really interesting history. I think it was actually an ingredient in 7-Up at one point. The soft drink 7-Up had lithium in it at one point.
Yes, lithium's very interesting. There was a fashion for using lithium in the 19th century because it was thought to help with stones and gout. There was a lot of doubt about in the 19th century and a lot of concern about it. And it was thought that lithium might dissolve the crystals that cause gout. And it might also, it was thought that it might also dissolve kidney stones. And it was found not to do this, but it still continued to be sold and marketed for this purpose. And one of the reasons that I think that lithium got taken up by psychiatry was because it was available in the hospital pharmacies because of this previous history of its use. And so when this man, John Cade, experimented with it in Australia, and then Mogens Schuh, the Danish psychiatrist, started using it in Denmark, they were able to convince people to use it because it was there in the pharmacy and there was a history of using it. Because otherwise, I think it would have seemed like quite a bizarre idea. It's an alkaline metal and it's very toxic, and it can easily kill people, and that's why people who take lithium have to have blood tests and have to be very careful not to take too much. And the interesting thing from the point of view of what we're talking about is that when people started to suggest that it might be useful in psychiatry in the 1950s, they were very much suggesting that it was a specific treatment for manic depression. No one thought about what psychoactive effects it might be producing. But it's quite obvious from volunteer studies that it has these sedative effects. It dampens down the nervous system. It slows up thinking, slows up reaction times, makes you feel very groggy, possibly also reduces creativity and spontaneity. And so, of course, it's going to slow people down a little bit if they're manic. But that doesn't mean it's a specific treatment at all. It's going to do that to anyone.
So it doesn't have a targeting effect on some bipolar mechanism in the brain, just like the antipsychotics don't have a targeting of psychotic mechanisms. They just have this tranquilizing effect that will actually affect anyone that takes them.
I think that the effects that we know that lithium has in normal people are, you know, easily able to explain the effects it has in if you give it to someone with mania or bipolar disorder. I don't think you need to have any additional explanation. No one's come up with a credible theory about what it might be doing in manic depression that is specific in any way. There are various speculations that it might be stabilizing the cell membrane or correcting electrolyte imbalances, but nothing concrete has ever been found or even proposed really that makes sense of that.
When people are prescribed lithium, they're put on a regular dose for long term, and the idea is that it's going to prevent future episodes, again with this fear in the background, because often it's a really catastrophic event. You have an incredible manic episode, you have this altered state of consciousness, you lose your job, it's incredibly shameful, and then the terrifying experience of going into the hospital, and then there's the fear of suicide. And so people are told, look, you need to be on this long term to prevent going back to that crisis. What about that aspect of it?
I think you're absolutely right. I think manic depression is a very frightening condition. And I think what's happened is that lithium and other medications have been held out as a magic bullet for this frightening disorder. And of course, people have wanted to have something that they could pin their hopes on. The trouble is that the research that has looked into whether or not lithium helps to reduce the risk of relapse has lots of problems, and the main problem it has is that what these studies have done is they've taken people who've been on lithium for a long time already, and then they've randomized half of them to stay on the lithium and half of them to have their lithium stopped. And it appears that if you stop your lithium especially quickly, that's such a shock to the body that it can actually precipitate a manic episode. And so a lot of these studies that are supposed to support the value of taking lithium long-term are probably simply showing that if you stop lithium, you get into problems. And because of that, if we're starting lots of people on long-term lithium, we're storing up lots of potential problems. Unless people take it forever, if they ever stop it, they're more likely to have a relapse than they would be if they'd never gone on it in the first place.
so many people are told that when you have a crisis, that it's your underlying disease, your underlying disorder is coming back. And then actually, for a lot of people, it's the medication withdrawal. They've missed medication, they stopped their medication, and the rebound, the withdrawal effect, is what leads to a psychotic episode as a result of the medication, not some underlying condition that they had before.
Yes, well, I mean, I think that's the case in some circumstances, and it seems to be particularly true after stopping lithium. Everything that happens after someone stopped medication or reduced medication is attributed to the illness. People don't take into consideration very much anyway the possibility that there might be a withdrawal effect.
Tell us about the mood stabilizer drugs, which are now used in addition to lithium for bipolar disorder.
The concept of a mood stabilizer is very misleading because none of these drugs have been shown to stabilize, to stop mood fluctuations or reduce mood fluctuations in normal people or in anyone. They don't do that. They're just sedative drugs.
Is there any research that taking lithium or taking these anticonvulsant drugs actually lowers the risk of suicide?
There are a lot of people claiming that at the moment. There are some academic psychiatrists claiming that lithium in particular reduces the risk of suicide. In my opinion, these claims are based on very flawed studies, and these studies are flawed because what they do is they discount anyone who stops lithium. So anyone has problems with lithium or is possibly going into a deep depressive phase and doesn't stop taking it is immediately discounted from the figures. So they're actually only looking at people who are doing quite well and are able to keep taking their lithium over a long period. And therefore, I don't think they're really giving a fair estimate of suicide rates. And then there were also some studies that show quite high rates of suicide in people who take lithium. There's one from the 1980s, a British-based study, quite a large one, that showed quite a raised rate of suicide in people taking lithium.
And there's a potential role in drug withdrawal itself in being a factor in suicide.
Yes, well, there is a bit of research showing that as well. It's showing that possibly there's an increased suicide rate after stopping lithium.
One of the things that we mentioned before is that lithium was very popular and kind of these patent medicines in the early part of the 20th century. And I had mentioned that it was in 7-Up and beer, but it's really very toxic chemical. People sometimes say, well, it's a salt, it's a natural salt, but it's actually quite dangerous.
The supposed therapeutic effects of lithium are milder manifestations of those toxic effects. So when you get toxic from lithium, when you've had an awful lot of lithium, you get confused and very drowsy. When you've had just a bit of lithium, you get rather sedated and slowed up.
Yeah, I've met a number of people over the years who have had kidney transplants as a result of lithium long term.
Yes, it can have quite severe effects on the kidneys as well.
I think you wrote that an early psychiatrist who questioned the use of lithium for manic depression called it, quote, the treatment of the manic patient by lithium poisoning.
Yes, I found that quotation. That was interesting, wasn't it? So you see, there were people around who were saying that, who recognized that situation even then, but they were drowned out essentially by the enthusiasm of the people who suggested that lithium was a specific medical treatment.
Well, this brings us to an aspect of your work that I think is really interesting, which is that you describe psychiatric medications as having an aspect of social control. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how you see it fitting into some of the larger political issues here?
Yes. Well, psychiatric problems consist of behavior that someone doesn't like. It may be the person who's showing the behavior who doesn't want to be behaving in this way, but it may be other people who don't like the behavior of someone close to them. And psychiatric medications are designed to try and change that behavior, and therefore they are about control. But the thing that is happening is because they are called medical treatments and because the behavior is given a diagnosis and called a medical disorder, that control is obscured and it's dressed up as medical treatment, as meds. And that means that it's easier to go to more extremes than you might otherwise go in changing behavior because the therapist or the mental health service staff are not being held accountable for changing people. because it's assumed that what they're doing is in the person's interest because they're giving them medical treatment.
Joanna Moncrief, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks very much, Will. It's really nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to an interview with Joanna Moncrief. She is senior lecturer at the University College in London, a practicing psychiatrist with the National Health Service. She's the co-chair of the Critical Psychiatry Network and author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure, a critique of psychiatric drug treatment. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
And it is 12 o'clock noon. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Rheta Christie, and this is the Noontime Jamboree.
I'm looking for a cowboy and a handsome one, of course, with a two-seated saddle and a one-gated horse. And I'm yearning for a blue sky with a great big yellow moon and a slow-riding cowboy.